Hey everyone, welcome to the Juicy Patterns podcast. Today I have the pleasure to have Mr. David J. Plant is the co-author of this amazing book, which is, I love it. It completely changed how I approach design and how I approach my work, how I design products. Is the founder of Precoil, and yeah, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. Thanks for inviting me on.
Yes, thank you so much for your time. So, this book completely changed how I approach design for the reason that it changed the mindset. Instead of like in design school, they keep telling us that we need to be very perfectionist and to do things the right way, and design is the most important skill. And eventually when I read it, I learned that everything is an experiment. So could you please, share about that mindset? What is an experimental mindset?
Yeah, I don't think most people know I have a background in design, because that's where I started off my career, was in design. And I got really frustrated by making something pixel perfect that didn't solve a real need or problem sometimes. So some of this is personal experiences that are feeding into the book. But from an experimental mindset, it's really just this idea of having a kind of a growth mindset, being open to the idea that we could be wrong and there could be evidence that contradicts what we believe. And I think when you have a very fixed mindset, it's very difficult to go through the scientific method. And so this idea of, what's our riskiest assumption? Let's go test and find out. Let's look for some evidence and let's get insights from that. And let's be willing to change and adapt based on that. So it's really very much just going through that loop and being open to the idea that you could be wrong. I think that's the mindset that I would really stress in this process.
I found it hard to convince designers, and not just designers, and entrepreneurs in general to keep doing experiments. They're doing experiments just when they have to validate something. Like if our design partners would buy from us or something like that. And I'm trying to, what are we testing? What are we like, what are we doing here? Like, how do we measure it? So it's great. I would like to ask you, how do you, in this explosion of AI, I've noticed that people don't know how to use it properly. And I wouldn't do discovery with ChatGPT, like never, ever. So what's your approach towards discovery session using AI? And how do you do that?
It's evolving. I would say there are some efforts out there to just basically ask ChatGPT as if it was a customer and get answers. And my problem with that is it sounds very confident in all the answers it's providing, and you're not really sure where it's pulling all those answers from, even though you can define a persona and everything. And if you don't like the answer, you basically just like click regenerate over and over again until it gives you the answer you like to hear. So I have some problems with the generative part of it. Where I've been using it has been more almost like the opposite end, which is evaluative. So for example, you know, I have an interview script and I'm about to go run some interviews with this script. What are some things missing in this script? Or what are some things could be worded better, you know? Evaluate my script. Show me what's wrong or what could be better. Same things with a business model canvas or a value prop canvas or assumptions map. You know, here are my current assumptions. What else should I be thinking about, or how else could I word this? So I don't as much rely on the generative part of AI at the moment. That could change. Right now it's more I'm trying to stress test things and see like, where are my blind spots? Where are some things that I should be, some things I should be considering? And I find that much more valuable to me. And I'm trying to stay away from the, let's just not talk to customers anymore and just ask AI what the answer should be. I feel like that could potentially lead you down a wrong path where you're spending a lot of time and energy and money on something. And we didn't check to see if real customers had those needs or would pay enough.
That's what I thought about. I remember that I worked for a startup and they didn't do any get out of the building work, And eventually when ChatGPT just came out, they started to go wild on it. And you know what happened. I guess, you know, they're no longer here. I'm working with it, and I'm trying to mix it with a lot of methodologies that I learned. One of them is the design sprint. A design sprint, as you may know, is a 5-day magical process that validates assumptions with real prototypes. And I'm not buying it. Like I'm, you know, what's your approach? Like, how do you see that?
Well, I think one of the things with design sprints is the format in this. Are we talking to customers in the sprint? We should be, in my opinion. I think if you don't have customers in your design sprint, it's more of an art sprint. It's more of a creative sprint that you're doing, and you're not necessarily paying down your risk.
They do talk with customers, but it's very, you know, it's maybe 1 day or 2 days, and I'm not sure that they even talk with the right people. So
that's what makes it challenging about that short amount of period of time. I like the time box. I like time boxing work and discovery work. However, it also, you know, I volunteer for startup weekends and back in the day, lean startup machines, all these things that were on the weekend. And what would happen is, what if I can't get to my customer on the weekend? Or what if it's a B2B thing or I'm trying to go find a cardiologist? I'm not going to find a cardiologist in a coffee shop, probably. So this idea of not necessarily forcing a pivot or forcing a direction change because you weren't able to get in front of the person that you need to talk to. But I do like sprints in the sense of structuring work. So for example, I tend to go 6 to 12 weeks on early stage ideas with the teams I coach. And I don't want my teams getting too excited or too depressed after the first experiment. Because if we get too excited, we'll say, oh yes, now there must be a huge market for this, and let's jump to build and let's build this very polished solution. Or if we get negative results, we get too depressed and we say, there's nothing there, we'll just give up right away. And what I found over time, just through my coaching, is that you want a few experiments worth of work to see, is there any directional evidence here, and not necessarily make really big bets or big decisions off one test. So I like 6 to 12 weeks, because if you ran an experiment a week for 6 to 12 weeks, you should have 6 to 12 at least experiments worth of data to start looking at and have an informed opinion. Whereas if you really are tightly time boxing it too short, you potentially could give up too early, or you know, make really big bets on things that are very light evidence. So I like going a little longer, but I do like the rapid iterations of the sprints. I like rapid iteration, taking what you've learned and putting that into action and doing that over and over again.
So I know that there are, I think that the author of the book told in an interview, he said that he used it to make, I think it was Google Meet or something like that. So there are apps in the market that did started from a design sprint. So was it a coincidence? Like, was it a fluke? So can it be efficient even if we're not doing like the 3 months discovery sprint?
I think, you know, you look at some of the techniques that are folded into a sprint. So one of the techniques I really evangelize is assumptions mapping. And Google personally reached out to me to include it in their design sprint kit. So if you look at the sprint on Google's website, they do have they have the assumptions mapping in there in a section. They also have things like the business model canvas and other things as well. But what I do is I'm trying to plug into different formats versus try to define a very rigid, dogmatic format. So that's kind of my style. Is if you look at my content throughout the years, even the Testing Business Scientist book, it's essentially a plug-in to the business model canvas and the value prop canvas in a way where, okay, this can lead me to experiments. And I felt that was a missing piece to connect your strategy and what you're talking about to experiment design, you know? So when you look at sprints and you're trying to reverse engineer how successful they are and everything, I do think we have to be careful of trying to really, it's like causation versus correlation here, of how much the sprint contributed to a thing. But I do think, you know, going from low fidelity to high fidelity over time, giving yourself permission to increase fidelity as you learn more. I think constant contact with your customers and learning from that. I do think all this can help you make better decisions when you're designing something. So how much that contributed to an exact point of time with a sprint and the exact activities that were done, I don't know. But I do think that method of just giving yourself permission to invest more as you learn more, I am a big believer in that, because that'll help you. It should make you have better designs, and it should also help you make decisions when you should give up and not pursue something that's not worth polishing, because it's very frustrating to polish something that isn't being used, because you can feel really proud of it and you know it looks good and you know it behaves well and everything, but if it's not solving a real need, then ultimately was that a waste of time?
Yeah. That's how I felt after I read the book. I felt that there aren't enough, we didn't do interviews, and we didn't do that the entrepreneurs just gave us a list of names, just talk with them. And eventually, we did something that is beautiful. I don't know how efficient it is. So how do you, when we're doing experiments, we're using a lot of data, right? Whether it's quantitative or qualitative data, but there's always we need room for creativity. How do you balance the need to go with the data that we got and to be more creative about stuff that we feel in our gut that we should check?
Yeah, it is a balance. And I think about even other methodologies to creative work. So if you look way back at when Agile first became popular, you can look at the video game industry. You know, I've coached some video game companies in the past, and there was this tension there even with, well, video game design is inherently creative work, and how could I possibly time box that or test my things with players and get feedback on it? There is a balance to that, and it's not necessarily unique to testing, but also to any iterative process. So the way I try to approach this is, one, I try to get what you're worried about out of your head and visualized. You know, what are some things that you're worried about that could cause this whole thing to fail when you're working on a design? And then how do we prioritize that? How do we start to test some of that? And there could be multiple paths we choose, right? There's some paths we go down and we say, oh, that's not the right path. Let's back up and go down a different path. So we do have to be careful about going all in really early on a specific path and just saying, oh, let's design 20 experiments to get on this path and just follow that plan. There is an element of backing up and going forward. So I know the double diamond thing is completely overused, and it's been plastered, and if it's not diamonds, it's circles, and then there's more circles on circles, and there's all these different, you know, meme posts on it and everything. But this idea of, you know, going wide and then deciding, right? So I love taking some of the stuff I learned in design thinking and I learned early in design school, which was, let's, you know, go wide on some of the opportunities, and then let's start testing some potentially in parallel, and then being able to see what kind of evidence did we have. What does that inform as far as we go down a different path? But I do think it's an element of balance. Like, you can't always just go with your gut. So it's kind of like, can you check your gut against reality and get some evidence, qualitative, on whether or not, you know, your gut is correct. I think that's the difference between art and, you know, design to an extent, and also, you know, other things around that field, is can we use our creativity and balance it with testing it against reality. I think it's always a challenging balance.
Yeah, I totally agree. And what do you do if you don't have the resources to do that? If you're a small startup, like 2-3 entrepreneurs, maybe with a designer, so the quality of the experiments is it's not that good. If you need to spread to check a few directions, so you put less time on each one, doesn't it make it a bit, you know? Yeah.
It can be challenging. I think one of the ways I try to approach that is, when I come back to fidelity, of an experiment. So you think about fidelity of going from even something simple to, let's go from a sketch to like a wireframe to maybe a clickable prototype that looks a little better, but isn't still very much, isn't real yet, isn't wired up behind the scenes or anything like that. If you think about that progression, I don't start with really high-end, high-fidelity, expensive tests to go after multiple opportunities. Where I would recommend is say, let's start quick and get some evidence at all, like directional evidence that, you know, even if something we sketched out, let's sketch it out in three different ways and test with customers that way. And I've done that a lot with different companies I coach, where we don't want to go too high-end and spend more money on creating something very polished when we're very early stage, because it also, it changes the kind of feedback you get. You get a lot of usability feedback in a way when you say show something polished in front of people. You get, oh, I wish that was blue instead of red, or I wish this button was up here. And early stage ideas, I'm just trying to figure out, do you have a job to be done or a pain you're experiencing or a gain you're looking for? Or what's the desire for a thing, like the value in it? I don't care as much about usability. And so I do think we have to be careful about when we go polished really early and we did polished in multiple directions, that the kind of feedback we're getting, we're not misinterpreting that and saying, oh, because you're giving me usability feedback on this high fidelity thing I've shown you, that means you value it and you're going to pay for it. Because people give feedback on things all day. It doesn't mean they actually value it and will pay for it. So I try to keep low fidelity going to high fidelity as we get more evidence. And I find that testing multiple directions with low fidelity is easier than testing multiple directions at a higher fidelity.
I would like to ask you something regarding visual design. What is the importance of visual design in experiments? So you just said that when you're just starting out experimenting with something, low fidelity is fine. But when we progressed with our experiments, we need to make it look more trustworthy, right? From a brand that we can trust. So what is the importance of visual design in that aspect?
It's extremely important. And it's one of the reasons I always recommend having a designer on your team when you're testing out your ideas. Because if you don't, what can happen is you have false negatives. So for example, even take something simple as a landing page. And now I know there are all kinds of different landing page templates now, and it's not as a challenge as it was maybe 5 to 10 years ago to spin up a landing page. But if your landing page is visually so rough that it doesn't look trustworthy, then even if your value prop is strong, you're going to get a negative response to it because of the visual representation of it. You know, so it's always a balance of, when I say increasing fidelity, we're also trying to get closer to the real world experience, or closer to a very trustworthy real world experience. And in that, you do have to spend time in visual design, because if you neglect it, you might end up prematurely killing an idea because it doesn't look trustworthy. And so that progression from a sketch to something that looks like this is ready for the real world and can be trusted, you have to incorporate visual design in that journey. Otherwise, again, you might be killing something because people look at it and say, well, this, I can't trust this, even though I like the value proposition. You don't want to neglect design in that regard.
It's interesting because I'm always, I keep hearing about this discussion, whether the true power, let's say the power of a designer, is not being a great design thinker or being good at understanding the business model canvas, or it's being able to create great visuals, because at the end of the day, that's what makes us unique. Because a product manager can create all those kind of wireframes and low fidelity sketches. Do you believe that?
Less so anymore. I would say, I say this because I've literally given workshops and taught courses at CCA out here in California, and two artists on how to think about business models and how to think about risks and assumptions. And so I think the luxury of not being connected to the financials of things, it's not there as, it's not as common as it used to be. You know, it used to be, I could be completely isolated and I'm going to make things look beautiful and visually appealing, and someone else is going to figure out the business model around that. And what I'm seeing more often are designers saying, oh, wait, I want to know at least the basics of the business model, or I want to know how this could influence and move the needle some way with our revenue. And so I'm seeing more of that pushed to designers, whether by necessity or just the way organizations are structured anymore. But I'm seeing this need for designers to better understand that. And it's not just at the orgs, right? I'm going into academies and universities and showing them there as students, right? Like, it's not something that I feel it's getting pulled more upstream in education even. So I don't know if it's going to continue to trend that way, but just based on my own work, I see more designers needing to know at least the basics of the business model and knowing how their designs are going to influence that business model than ever before.
Okay, so another question that I wrote to myself, how designers can change the perception of their work by getting familiar with different types of experiments, with greater knowledge, with experiment types, for example, changing the CDA to have stronger evidence.
Yeah, I think it's good for designers to just be aware of strength of evidence and the currency you're asking for from the customer. So for example, in your design, are you asking for them to sign up with email? Okay. While great, that anymore nowadays is pretty light evidence in the sense of people will give up their email more so than they would 10, 15 years ago. It's not necessarily something they treasure. We get spammed all the time. It is a sign of interest, but it's very light versus saying, you know, enter your payment information because this is something we're going to pre-order, which is much stronger strength of evidence. Now, I know a lot of people say you have to charge from day one. I think that's very case-by-case basis, but you want to know that asking for email is not the same as asking for payment information. Even from the design perspective, it'll look different, but from a just strength of evidence perspective, you could have, let's say, a landing page, and the strength of evidence it gives off is going to vary if you ask for something like an email versus asking for payment information. And so I think just being aware of that can help you inform the design. And when you're thinking about, okay, in this design, we're asking for stronger evidence or a higher investment from the customer, how might I design for that? And versus, oh, we're just asking for email. So I think the mistake I see sometimes is people use, like, they'll just change the words, right? It's almost like the same call to action. And it's like, enter your payment information, you know? And in reality, from a design point of view, you have to think deeply and step in the shoes of the customer there. And okay, I'm about to give my payment information for this. Like, what would I need to see to do that versus, oh, this is enough for me to enter in my email. I do think just being aware of that will help you as a designer to better design for those experiences.
Another question that I have is how to think like a scientist. I read the book Lateral Thinking of Edward de Bono, and he says that you need to think in lateral movement, and scientists usually think in vertical movement. They rely on stuff that they already learned. So in a way, designers need to alter their mindset. So do you have any recommendation to change into a scientific mindset?
Yeah, it takes time. I'm still working on it even. It's, you know, this, when we kicked this conversation off, we were talking about having an open mind and being, not just confirming your beliefs, right? So I think even when I'm talking about going from lower fidelity to higher fidelity, it's not necessarily just a linear thing where I'm checking the boxes going, okay, I did a wireframe. Okay, now I'm going to do a clickable prototype. Okay, now I'm going to do some kind of MVP. Like, you want to be more than just going through the motions and checking the box. You should be learning either new insights that are shaping your designs and challenging your thinking, or maybe they're unclear insights and you're going back and testing again to see if, hey, we didn't learn what we were trying to learn there. Can we do that a different way? Or was there noise in the data that prevented us from learning what we needed to learn? So it's very much iterative that way. And so when you think about how to think like a scientist, it's usually, okay, what am I worried about? Like, what am I really worried about with this design? How would I go test that sooner versus later? And then be open to the fact that, okay, I might learn something different there. And with DeBono, you know, I try to weave this stuff into giving feedback. So for example, if we think about our assumptions maps or experiment design, I'm often saying, okay, what's ambiguous about this? So what's confusing to me? And I'll ask clarifying questions. You know, can you clarify what you meant by this assumption? Or can you clarify a bit what you meant by this experiment? What are the details here? I'm a little confused. Or I might say, what's missing? Like, this would something you like to try, you know, like, I'd really think we should try this. You know, what are your thoughts? Or potentially, like, what's wrong? So look, it looks like we're trying to combine way too many things into this experiment. I think we should split these up into multiple tests. It'll make it easier instead of trying to combine them all. And so little things like that, I try to weave through my coaching. And but it does take time. It's a lot of it's very humbling in the sense of I really wanted this to work, and I wanted it to work a specific way to kind of bring this back down to a real story. So we tested the book, you know, when I was writing the book, we tested all the different parts. We tested the covers, we tested the layouts, we tested the content. And there was a lot of feedback that I did not want to hear. You know, there were certain book covers I wanted to win. And when I heard people were explaining the book cover back to me, as much as I wanted that book cover to win and I wanted just to go forward with it, I realized, wow, they do not understand what this book is about based on this cover. All these little things that we thought were obvious, they were very confused about. So we should go back and reevaluate, you know, the cover that we were going to go forward with. And it was very humbling to me because even I do this as a living, and I thought, oh, I really don't need to test that. This is going to win anyway. Let's just
reality
move forward to the
check.
Next part.
This is something that I'm teaching, and eventually it's something that I, it's really hard to get the reality. So David, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking with you. I can't stress that enough, like how much this book is important. To understand the mindset. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking with you, and that's it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me during the conversation.